Thanks a lot, Joe. Okay, for our second keynote this morning, I wanted to introduce David McGrew. He's a Cisco Fellow with Cisco Systems. He's an expert in cryptography and network security who's engaged in both theory and practice. He was instrumental in the development of several standards, including GCM and Secure RTP. David was chair of the Internet Research Task Force, the Crypto Forum Research Group, and he's active in the Internet Engineering Task Force. Before joining Cisco, he was a cryptographic scientist at Trusted Information Systems. He holds a PhD in physics, and he'll be speaking on assuring the faithfulness of crypto modules and automated runtime validation for cryptographic modules. Thanks, David. I'll let you find your own slides there. There we go. There we go. So, I'm Whit Diffie. Nice. So, I'm really glad to have the opportunity to talk to you today about assuring the faithfulness of our cryptography. I think this is an important issue. I think it's a good way to look at things. I'm going to be talking about some topics that are familiar to you, maybe in a different way. So, the major goal of my presentation is to highlight an opportunity. I'm going to be talking about an opportunity and not a solution, right? So, the opportunity is to use existing technologies and practices that we've developed for validation to address the issue of unfaithful cryptographic modules, right? So, I'm using a new term here, unfaithful. Here's what I mean by faithful, right? A faithful crypto module does exactly what its user expects and nothing more, right? So this is a very simple, easy definition. And what's more interesting are the examples of unfaithful crypto modules, right? An unfaithful crypto module would be one that had a side channel of some sort by which it could leak information that was secret or private, such as a secret key, and then could leak that out to an adversary. So here we have Alice and Bob having an innocent communication session, and Alice's crypto module is being unfaithful to her and is, you know, leaking out a secret key somehow. So the risk is that an adversary could be monitoring communication between Alice and Bob and also be aware of this side channel and learning about the secret key, you know, because the adversary was, you know, aware of it, you know, maybe, you know, got a weakness inserted in this module. So the module's unfaithful to Alice in the sense it's doing this, she's not aware that it's going on. And I'm using this term, you know, faithfulness, because I'm not saying trustworthy, right? Because I want to be really precise about this. I'm trying to view faithfulness as orthogonal to correctness, right? So there's a lot of great technologies and practices on assuring the correctness of a crypto module, but these practices traditionally have not embraced the idea of assuring faithfulness as well. So, you know, a correct crypto module would, you know, pass all of its algorithm validation tests and its entropy tests and its power on self test and so forth, but it still might be unfaithful, right? That, you know, once you actually get it in the field, it decides, hey, I've got this great implementation of elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, but I'm not going to use it. I'm actually going to, you know, I'm not going to use it in the way my user thinks I'm going to use it. I'm going to do something else. So when I'm saying faithful, I'm meaning something that's orthogonal to correctness here. And here's what I mean by an assurance of faithfulness, right? In crypto module validation, we have the idea of a trusted third party. He's labeled T here, who can provide an independent assessment of a crypto module and help to assure that it's good. And what I'm suggesting is that this assurance could be extended to include the idea of faithfulness as well. And this is especially powerful because, you know, government customers and, you know, as well as enterprises, you know, care very much about faithfulness. And, you know, so it would be a great thing for this community to be able to provide an assurance that a module has been vetted for faithfulness as well. And what this means is just being aware of the different sorts of attacks that can take place on faithfulness and extending our practices somewhat. And you'll notice in my diagram here, I've illustrated that the trusted third party is showing that they're, you know, ensuring that there's no subliminal channel. The attacker is always going to be there, right? The adversary is always out there listening, storing communication in hope of future information and whatnot, right? So in the real world, the attacker is always there. So I'd like to talk about the crypto module lifecycle. So I have this is my view of the software crypto module lifecycle. I'm focusing on software because I think it's important and it's what I know best. My apologies to my friends in the hardware side of things. So very often the lifecycle of cryptography looks something like this. We have a standard that gets developed. You know, perhaps it's based on some academic work, perhaps it's something that has been around a long time and a standard is developed for it. There could be open source software that implements the standard. And in fact, you know, if you're pushing a standard, if you've developed a standard and you want people to support it, they practically expect you to have open source. So open source is very common. And many vendors take advantage of open source. Open source is incredibly important, right? And just to give an example of that, look at all the Linux that's out there and look at all the cryptography that's in Linux, right? If you do a source code install that has full source and then you can grep through it and look for all the algorithms, it's so much data, I didn't want to present it all, right? But there's a huge amount of crypto there. So people are importing open source cryptography sometimes, you know, without even realizing that there's cryptography in there. Within a vendor, you know, we have source code that'd be proprietary, maybe multiple open source sources, and then it gets turned into an executable. And then it goes to a distribution channel, right? So this distribution channel might be, it's burned to an optical disk, it's burned into a product and then shipped, or it might be that it's up on the internet to be pushed out through like a DevOps sort of model, which is the modern cloud-based, we push a new executable to your device without you knowing it while you sleep kind of model. But there is going to be some distribution channel. The executable will be there, and then finally it gets to the end user. And so this might be in the form of say a device that sits on the customer network or on the desktop, and the end user could be an organization that relies on the crypto module to protect their communication. So there's all sorts of opportunities to make a crypto module unfaithful all throughout the life cycle. So the designer of a standard could potentially make the standard weak in some way. That this has been something that's, I think there's been a lot of speculation about this. It certainly would be possible. An open source contributor has a great opportunity to insert a flaw that would be then inherited by all the vendors and other users of the open source package. And there's been a lot of flaws in open source software, and there's been some speculation that some of them are actually intentional flaws, right? That would be, an attack on faithfulness in my terminology. So an insider at an organization has a great opportunity to insert a weakness as well, right? So this could be somebody that gets bribed or threatened at a vendor or in a distribution channel or at an end user, right? So the insider threat is a big one. That's the one that the security industry really has a hard time grappling with traditionally. And then lastly, a hacker who can get access, say, inside of a vendor and can insert something in the source code, essentially is the same sort of threat as an insider, right? That there's all sorts of techniques such as phishing attacks or attacks against passwords where you can get, say, a developer's login credentials and insert something in the source code. When you look at the size of source code that many vendors have to grapple with, we're in the millions of lines, and we have thousands of developers, right? So the opportunity to slip something in, if there's not an assurance practice around it, is a real one. So let me go over some examples of possible attacks just to motivate this, right? I mean, in previously I was talking kind of in an abstract level. Back in 97, Ryman and Pernille described how to design a block cipher that would have a hidden vulnerability in it. And their approach basically is, I'm going to make my substitution tables really, really big, so big that you can't find the linear flaws that I'm putting in there. And so, you know, that's an example of how, you know, it might be possible to insert something, a flaw like that in a really fundamental primitive like a block cipher. Another area of, a possible attack of this sort is this patent that's due to Vanstone and Brown, which is an elliptic curve random number generator that incorporates key escrow, which a number of people have observed is like the dual EC DRBG standard. And as far as open source goes, Heartbleed, this was a widely known attack. It's not actually on the cryptography. It's on another aspect of the protocol, but it's a great example of if you wanted to come up with a software flaw that would undermine security, that would look plausibly like a bug, but would give you the access that you wanted if you were an attacker, it's Heartbleed. Right? So I'm not saying that the open source maintainer that put it in there was doing it maliciously, but what he gave us was a proof of concept that somebody with malice could do just that. And so to not pick on open source, since I work for a vendor, the Apple go-to-fail bug was a similar sort of thing, pretty much the exact same thing as Heartbleed in scope. And you know, it's a bug that would be the perfect bug if you wanted it to look like a bug, but it's actually serving somebody other than the end user. And lastly, on the executable side of things, once you turn something into an executable, you know, there's still attacks, right? It's possible to do a code injection attack to modify the binary or, you know, possibly, affect the configuration, right? There's certainly hard-coded parameters inside of an executable are fairly easy to tweak. And these sorts of attacks could be done at any point inside in the vendor, in the distribution channel, or on the end user's devices. Right, so in other words, you know, you might visit a website with your web browser, and the malware would say, oh, I'm going to subvert the cryptography of this guy, right? And that, you know, given the vulnerabilities that exist in many operating systems and applications, right, is a possible thing. So I don't want to focus too much on this, but the unauthorized code incident at another major router vendor is a great example that it actually touches on a number of points in the life cycle. So the dual EC DRBG was added to the VPN product, and it was done with certain parameters that didn't match the standard. So it's the provenance of those things are unknown, but it probably means somebody has access to a backdoor using the published backdoor. The research publication that showed that such a thing was possible. And then somebody apparently, either a hacker or an insider, I have no idea, went in and modified the parameters in the executable to change it so that somebody else had a backdoor. So this is a great example of why you don't want to like stick in some universal backdoor in things is because, an attacker can exploit it to their advantage. So some possible attacks, I'll try to run quickly through this. So attacks on key generation, right? A crypto module could generate a key that's not actually from the whole key space, but instead from a small subset, right? That could apply to encryption or key establishment, right? And notice, for a key establishment protocol, it's essential in here, the crypto module needs to interoperate with other crypto modules, right? But with key generation, you could generate a key in a way that made the key more predictable to a certain adversary. And signature generation is also potentially a vector for leaking secret information. And of course, encryption is maybe the most studied example. Detectability varies a lot. And this is really important when we're thinking about assurance. So two types of testing to consider: black box testing and implementation review. So black box testing is good because it's easy, right? You can take, somebody gives you a completed module, say, I have this executable that is in my product. I want to see that it matches the thing that you've done validation on. You can look at the public keys coming out of it and the ciphertext coming out of it, and you can verify that the public keys appear to be generated properly and so forth. But however, you can't detect all attacks. Suppose that somebody, you know, borked your box so that it was generating Diffie-Hellman keys from a set of size 2 to the power 64, right? So in order to detect that bias, you'd have to, you know, black box test and generate 2 to the power 64 keys, right? So your black box testing has its limitations, which is why we need implementation review. And this is a great strength, right? In validation practices, we have review processes where a trusted third party looks at the code and verifies that things are being done correctly. So this is exactly the paradigm we want. We want somebody that we trust to look at the implementation, tell us it's good, and provide us a way of making sure that the thing actually running, it matches the thing that was validated. So I'm going to talk in a little bit of detail about the algorithm substitution attack. So within the research literature, ASA has become the prime example. Historically, you know, like back in 2000, Moti Young and Adam Young did a bunch of work they called kleptography, right, which is a wonderfully clever name, which was 15 years before its time, apparently. But more recently, the idea of mass surveillance by tricking everybody into using a crypto algorithm that's unfaithful to them has received more attention from the research community. And Bellare and Patterson and Rogaway did the first work, and as you can see, mass surveillance is its main focus. Just to give a little flavor on that, say Alice and Bob wanted to have a secure communication session, and the adversary is listening in, and they're going to use CBC encryption. So the way that works is we generate a random IV, and then that starts off our block chaining, and we're encrypting with a strong block cipher and a well-chosen key, so everything's good, except what if the implementation actually did something like this? That instead of randomly choosing the initialization vector, it took the secret key and a little bit of randomness as well, and then would choose an IV in a way that the adversary could recover, you know, part of the key from the initialization vector. Right? So this is an attack that, I should say, this algorithm, right, is perfectly feasible, and the paper that I showed on the previous slide, you know, basically describes a way to do this that's undetectable, right? So in their definition, strongly undetectable would mean that our black box test doesn't work unless you could break the cryptography. So in general, you'll find in this area that deterministic things can't be used to leak secret keys, but randomized algorithms can. And that really motivates us to think about what parts of our crypto module are deterministic and what are not. Because if it's deterministic, we could potentially validate it and as being, you know, faithful to its specification. And you know, by isolating all of the entropy and all of the randomness, we can achieve a better separation and provide a better assurance of this sort of faithfulness. So I want to briefly mention protocol side channels. So algorithm substitution attacks, as they've appeared in the research literature, are very interesting. But an important point is that if you look at something like the transport layer security protocol, there are plenty of other ways to leak secret key information out. So, and this is different than an algorithm substitution attack. This is just other side channels. Randomized padding, for example. The TLS and other similar protocols have a way to hide message lengths by adding random padding, and this facility can leak at least 4 bits per message, which many HTTPS sessions are long enough that if you leaked 4 bits per TLS record, that you could recover the entire key. So the way to do this attack would be, I implement something that leaks 4 bits of the secret key every time I encrypt the TLS record, and then I observe what website my victim goes to, and then I visit the same website myself. I know exactly what the TLS record's lengths are, and then I can look at what their implementation record lengths are, because that's visible on the wire. So with that, you can directly recover this information. So there's a lot of variability in other parts of the protocol. So this is not something that's strictly algorithm limit focused. We need to, as a community, be aware of the issues showing up in protocols. So what can we do about this? Right, I've talked about a lot of threats against our end customers. And the positive thing is that a lot of the practices, procedures, and technologies that we're working with could be used to directly address these issues. So one thing we could do is we could choose algorithms that are deterministic or substitution resistant in the literature terms. So for example, there's a variant of elliptic curve DSA that is deterministic, and perhaps that's something worth considering. Open source needs better vetting and better formal tracking of reviews. So Cisco is one of the funders of the Linux Foundation's Core Infrastructure Initiative. It's something that's open source focused. It's not just Linux focused, but the idea is to do a better job of security in open source. And I have a software background. I need to harp on this. When a security expert looks at software and reviews it and says, this is good, this is implemented correctly, and it's implemented in a way that's faithful to the user, we need to track the fact. And the next time somebody comes along with a patch and says, I want to change that software, put this patch in there, we should say no, right? Security review is incredibly valuable. It is seriously a valuable resource, and if we tracked it better, we could do a better job of providing overall solutions. So independent validation is, in a sense, what a lot of this conference is about, right? And independent validation of the faithfulness of a crypto module, the fact that, hey, it implements this algorithm, here's how it gets a key, here's the algorithm it uses, that there's a lot of value. And so, describing the crypto module as being faithful, in a sense, is just, adding another checkpoint to some of the processes we're already doing. And as far as the research goes, we could potentially do a better job of this if we tracked the reviews better, like I was harping on before. And potentially in the longer term, I think static analysis of source code and VHDL would be good technology to pursue in this space, where we want to detect all sorts of issues, intentional and non-intentional. I would love to see research that specifically addressed hidden flaws in software. Finding hidden flaws in software, I should say, not putting them in. And then runtime validation is a really interesting possibility, potentially a really great solution. Imagine that, if we had an executable in a product, that we have a crypto module that's actually all compiled and ready to run, and we can interact with it in a way that it's assuring us of its correctness and its faithfulness, right? This is the kind of thing where we want a trusted third party involved, probably, because not every end user wants to do this validation. But being able to perform a validation at runtime is really powerful. So it mitigates late in the life cycle, right? So by being doing this runtime validation, we can potentially detect all of the attacks that occurred anywhere previously. And this is a really important thing. So runtime validation essentially is when the crypto module interacts with an external trusted element, And this has been taken up by the NIST CMVP Government Industry Working Group. It has a subgroup that's specifically looking at algorithm test automation, and I encourage you to go to that talk later. And you know, thanks to Apostle and CMVP for kicking this off. I think it's really great. So I'm going to conclude this way. I think faithfulness is important as correctness, and that our current practices can be brought to bear to provide assurance of faithfulness. I think that's something worth doing, and I think it's a way of describing things that adds to the value of everything we're doing here. So that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
We can take a couple questions if you want. We've got time for a couple questions if anybody'd like to ask David something.
We are going to go to the Apostle's talk, but I just wondered what is the essential difference between lab testing of your product and runtime testing? Because I would think that if you've got something interacting with that, it's not a production model. What exactly is the difference?
Well, one difference could be that the runtime testing could be done on a module that's in the field, as opposed to a sample of the module.
Would you repeat the question?
I'm sorry.
No problem.
What's the difference between existing lab testing and runtime validation? So in the sense, one of the differences is that it would be wonderful if we could test a particular crypto module as it appears in the field. And so, you know, somebody who attacks late in the life cycle in the distribution channel or in the, you know, the deployed product, right? These are real threats that exist in the real world, so it would be great if we could extend what we're doing so that it also addresses that.
Wouldn't that be integration specific? Because each system would be slightly different, you might have to be slightly different. So
It could be, and what I'm describing is aspirational.
Okay.
One more. Anybody? Here we go.
So the runtime testing seems to be like operational system testing. You have a crypto model embedded in the whole system. There are many other issues like in the testing, organizational policies or whatever. Is that true?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? I didn't hear the last part.
Runtime testing seems to be like the system operational testing in which there are all issues involved in the activity. Not only technical issues, but also operational policies and so on. Does that mean?
I'm not sure that I understand the question. And I'm sorry about that.
The question is that whether only in the runtime testing is technical issues involved, or is much more like an operational system testing in which other issues are involved, other disciplines, other, not only the technical one, the specific characteristics of the cryptographic model.
So runtime testing is a big complex issue. And you know, I just touched on it here. So I think maybe the best thing would be for us to talk later. I certainly acknowledge, yes, there are a lot of operational issues potentially around it. It's a big topic.
All right. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, David. Thank you again, Joe and Matt. Again, I'd like to thank all our sponsors, exhibitors, and attendees, and the program and planning committees. Next up is a networking break, which we're actually a few minutes into already. And all the regular sessions start at 10:45. Thank you again, and please enjoy the conference. Oh, also, we do have to clear the room to reset it, so everybody out, please.
People could do that would give them hey, here's best practices to ensure faithfulness. Yep. People would be all